We are taking a journey through the life of Jesus. If you, most of us know this here, every week we're on another step of our journey through the life of Jesus. Been going at it for a while now. We've got some months ahead of us still. But today, we come to a story that Jesus told that's next in our journey. And I'll be honest with you, just fair warning as we get started, the story that we come to today in our journey is a pretty intense one. In fact, it's a very heavy story. It's a sobering story that Jesus tells because he tells about life and then death and then afterlife, and he talks about a hellish afterlife. And hell's a big topic, and I realize that today that through the years of pastoring, we've talked about hell before, but we've been on this journey through the life of Jesus, and we're trying to get through this, and so I really would love to almost take a time at a moment like this and just spend a whole Sunday just talking about these things, but there's so much more. We could do a whole series on heaven and hell and all sorts of topics from Scripture. And we're not doing that today because we have this journey through the life of Jesus that we're trying to complete at a certain time. But one day we're going to come back and we're going to talk about maybe a whole series we'll do one day when this journey's over. We'll talk about difficult topics and controversial topics and hot topics, no pun intended. We'll just talk about them all when we get there. But today, we're going to talk about a story that Jesus tells of that backdrop. And I know that for a lot of us, and we have a different places in our faith journey in this room, and I know that for some of us, that topic brings insecurity or fear or questions or confusion. And I wanted to encourage you that if you don't want to wait until we can spend a whole Sunday or series of Sundays on that topic, to come see me. I'd love to talk about it because I believe that as we look at the Bible and the good news of Jesus, there's such hope in the middle of such heavy conversations. So let's talk about that together. I'd love that coffee. I'd love that bite to eat with you. That'd be great. But in the meantime, right now, I want to say this to all of us. Hell, in the word that we translate hell in the English language is used three different terms in the Greek language. And you get the New Testament, we call the Christian scriptures, there's three words translated from Greek into English that we called hell, but they were very three different words with three different connotations. And we don't always make that distinction because it's all, we just read what we read. Those three words and the theological presence of most Christians for the last 2,000 years understand that there might be a different views of the afterlife, both pre-death and resurrection of Jesus, post-death and resurrection of Jesus, and then think about the end times of everything one day. And those are all topics that are bigger than we have time for today. And me just bringing that up might stir up 20 questions in your mind. And I encourage you to come see me if you're on a journey that needs some things answered, or you're constructing or deconstructing a journey that needs that answered. So let's talk about that together. But today, we need to get into the story because Jesus tells that story not to teach a theological presence about the afterlife. Jesus tells the story to answer a question that was completely different, and we need to look at why he told the story, because most of the time this story is told, it's never told in the context of what Jesus was trying to accomplish. And so I'm going to do my best to deal with it today. Let me review last week. If you were missing last week, or even if you were here and you forgot, let's remember what we learned last Sunday. We saw a story that Jesus told about a man who was a financial manager for a rich man. The rich man this man worked exclusively for the rich man. It was his one client. But he was a dishonest manager. He was wasting his employer's money. And the employer found out about it and said, "I'm going to fire you. But before I fire you, I'll give you a chance to come and reckon the books to me. And if you can't reconcile what I hear on the books, then you will lose your job." And so before he lost his job, the manager went around to many of the loans that as he invested his employer's money, he went around to many of the debtors who owed him lots of money, businesses. And he said, "Listen, what do you owe? Let's cut it down in half or cut it by 20% and let's reduce your debt. And I have the authority to do that until I'm fired, so I'm going to do that for you. And the boss isn't going to be happy, but he's firing me anyhow, so who cares? But you might actually be able to benefit me later on." And sure enough, he's fired. And the lessons of the story that Jesus notes is that this man was very shrewd. In fact, Jesus actually says that oftentimes people of faith are less shrewd about dealing with the world around them than children of the world are, which is not how it should be. It's just how it is. And then Jesus made an application where he says, I want you not to waste what God entrusts, because we are all managers of what God has given us. We should never waste that. We should be good stewards, as the old word goes, or managers of that. But we also, he calls us to be generous. And he warned, don't be greedy. We saw last week a definition of greed that we have taught many times here at Lighthouse Church. I'll remind you again as we get started that we define greed. Greed is the assumption that it's all for my consumption. That's it. That everything that comes my way is for me. It's all for me. And if it's, I don't have to give it to you. If you need something, that's not my problem. Should have thought of that before you were born as peasants, you know? This is for me. It's mine. And so what we do is we wrestle with what's mine. And that might look like saving. I have a lot of money in the bank. I have a huge investment portfolio. That might look like spending. I buy stuff. I even borrow to buy stuff. I'll pay back later because I want stuff. Whether I'm a spender or a saver, greed is the assumption that it's all for my consumption. And we saw in the story that Jesus says, don't be greedy, be generous. In fact, Jesus gave this application, slightly reworded for application. Jesus said that we are to use our resources, use your resources to benefit others. And you'll find a benefit too. That when we use what God has given us and entrusted to us as managers to benefit others, not only are they helped, but we are also benefited as well. He told us to be faithful in the little things like worldly wealth so you can be entrusted with greater things. And then we closed last week with verse 13 of Luke 16. Luke 16, 13, the last verse we saw in review, Jesus said this. He says, no one can serve two masters, for you will hate one and love the other. You'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and be enslaved to money. The word money there is bigger than like cash. It refers to the things that money can buy, materialism. You can't serve God and be enslaved to the things of this world that entice us, because at some point, those two things will conflict. Which one do we serve? God will call us to do things that causes us to sacrifice what's our best, or what we're trying to achieve, or what we want to acquire. Or what we want to achieve and acquire will pull us away, and God will go to the back burner. And so at some point, we've got to decide who we serve. And money makes a wonderful servant, but it makes a terrible master. And Jesus warns. And so that was the last week's message. I'm reviewing that for us because it leads us into today. If you remember last week, Jesus told that story. It says in the first verse, Jesus told that story to his disciples. He was talking to his disciples. That's important to note. But as often is the case when Jesus would teach, people would gather around and a crowd would be there. Sometimes they were religious people, sometimes they were not religious people, sometimes they were just multitudes, and he would end up having a bigger audience, and that's what happens here in the next verse. Verse 14 says this, the Pharisees, who dearly loved their money, heard all of this, and they scoffed at him. Now, the Pharisees are the leading religious movement within Judaism. Judaism had factions, like religion often does, with like different factions, and the most powerful, influential faction within Judaism was the Pharisees, more than the Sadducees, more than the Essenes, more than other groups. And they were the most widespread. They had you know, schools of their own everywhere they went. They had unique things happening. They were very powerful, influential group. If you were to compare it to Christianity in the West today, it'd be like evangelicals probably. In their zeal, they were political. They were very protective of their sound. They would attack and chase off people who didn't toe the theological line that they agreed with. They were gatekeepers of what they believed was right. That's why they followed Jesus around and said, "We don't like this guy. We're going to find fault with what he said. We're going to discredit him. We want to kill him." That's why they followed the apostles around after Jesus, including Paul, wherever they went to try to hurt their ministries because they didn't agree with how they presented the things of God in their minds. But they were devout people who read their scriptures, memorized their scriptures, studied their scriptures, loved them, and fought for them. But they missed the point. And here they are, and they loved, Jesus says, Luke tells us they loved their money. And they did. They were very greedy. They took advantage of people to enrich themselves. In fact, some of the things that they did were just crazy to their own families. A couple quick examples so I don't get stuck here too long, but they would neglect their parents' needs as their parents got older by saying, oh, anything I would give to you has been designated as Corban or as a gift to God for me to use as I need to as I live my good life serving him, but that means I can't help you. And they would find loopholes to not help other people and abandon their family. They would use the scriptures to do things like that. They would oftentimes put their wives. If divorce was a rampant problem amongst Pharisee leaders. They would often ask Jesus about it. Can I, what are the loopholes by which I could put her away? The problem was in that culture, women, as we know, didn't have the standing they have. Women who were divorced or widowed were in desperate straits. Women, oftentimes, men accepted to marry a girl who was only ever his. He may have had a couple partners along the way, but she had better only ever be his and prove it. And if a girl was divorced or widowed, oftentimes they were in trouble if their parents weren't still there to care for them or their kids weren't old enough to care for them. And so divorce was devastating, and Jesus warned over and over to the Pharisees when discussing this, do not put her away, do not leave her in trouble, you are responsible. But they always found ways to do what's best for them economically or to leverage it with threats against the people around them because it was all about their love of money. And they heard Jesus talking in this text, as we just read last week and we reviewed just now. They heard Jesus talking to his disciples about, hey, don't be greedy. Don't be a greedy booger. Instead, be generous. And they scoffed. They're like, bah, humbug. To continue our Ebenezer Scrooge theme from last week. Bah, humbug. That's silly. This is my money. This is my stuff. I can serve God in this. This is what I've deserved this. And so Jesus is going to address them. Verse 15, then Jesus said to them, you like to appear righteous in public, but God knows your hearts. You like to put on a show that makes you look good on the outside. That people look around and say, man, they're impressive. They must really love the Lord. But God isn't checking out what other people are measuring, what you're wanting people to measure. He's looking at your heart. And he says, what this world honors is detestable in the sight of God. And it's interesting, he says, what this world honors, because we think of the world as not the religious people. But Jesus is like, religious or irreligious world. The world will honor the things that will make us look good, that will show off, and we know how to impress others with an outward show. But Jesus is saying, God doesn't care about that show. God's not looking at what they honor. He sees the heart, and he's grossed out by your greed. He's grossed out by that selfishness. He's calling you to a different place. That's maybe less measurable, but measurable before man. And so for the next few verses, Jesus talks about a few things in response to this criticism he's getting for what he taught his disciples, this criticism he's getting from these religious leaders who were greedy and not generous, as they made fun of his teaching. And he says a few things that we're gonna skip because we've already studied these things in past sermons that Jesus taught already. And we're gonna get to the story that he tells because Jesus is about to tell another story. But unlike last week, that story was for his disciples. This story is for the new audience that has come and is scoffing at his message. He says, I have a story for you now. Let's jump into it. Luke 16, 19, Jesus said, there was a certain rich man who was splendidly clothed in purple and fine linen, and who lived each day in luxury. So that's a description of what living in luxury looks like in those days. I don't know if anyone thinks this way besides me, but I was reading this for some time now, preparing. I was thinking, I'm glad I live in, I'd rather be middle class or slightly under in today's technology and creature comforts than the richest of the people back in those days. I don't know, it's just, I got the best of everybody as I stare at my rock collection, you know, and think, man, alive. I could use some central air and some a Netflix or something. I don't know. So, but yeah, this guy in those times, he's the rich. He's splendidly clothed. And this is how you know purple and fine linen were pricey. He lives each day in luxury. He has people who serve him. He's a rich man. In verse 20, it says this, at his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, who was covered with sores. Now, why is Lazarus covered with sores? Perhaps he has leprosy. Leprosy was a very common disease of that day. That could explain the sores. Or it could be something else. He could have malnutrition from not eating well and other things that's going on. But he is hurting. He's in physical pain. He's hungry. He's poor. And he stays outside of the gate of this rich man. Why? Because he can. I was thinking about this earlier in the early service. I was talking about how I really saw the juxtaposition of extreme wealth next to extreme poverty when I went overseas a few times. The first time was to the Philippine Islands. In our earlier service, there was a man in our service named Ted Dunn. Some of you might not know him if you don't come to that hour. Ted and I and my family, we went to the Philippines. It was my first experience of a few in other cultures where I saw for the first time with my own eyes extremely rich houses right next to extremely tragic existences. Right, I mean, not like in different neighborhoods across town, right next to each other. It was jarring how one could sit on top of the other. How could you live like that and then rich? And in this story, that's what's happening. This poor man is parked outside of the gate of this very rich man. And every time the rich man comes home, he sees the poor man Lazarus there with his sores and his desperate thing, and he can fix the problem. And that's probably why the poor man parked himself right there. Because for someone to help a very poor man would not be sacrificial, but for the rich man to help the poor man wouldn't cost him hardly a thing. He'd barely feel it. It'd barely dent his budget. But he never helped him. He probably came home every day and said, oh, this guy's still here. He's pulling down the property value of the neighborhood, you know. He's hurting the economy around us by being here. I don't know what he's thinking, but he's really just turned off. And it says in verse number 21 that as Lazarus lay there longing for scraps from the rich man's table, the dogs would come and would lick his open sores. Now, that's terrible. These aren't like house dogs. This is a little, you know, little foofy dog that barks at the window. These are wild dogs in the streets that lived out in the streets. They're coming around, they're licking his sores because it probably tasted good to them, and I'm sure it was a bit tormenting for him, but he's just trying to get close enough to get some help. But he never got it. He just wants the scraps. Because what the rich man would toss away from his leftover food would be the best food this guy would ever eat. The clothes the rich man would toss away because he's getting new clothes would be the best clothes this guy would ever wear. His scraps would be welcome. But he never gets them. You know how we know? Because it says he longed for them. He never received them. He spent his life wishing he could have them, and never in his journey did he receive them. He was ignored. Verse 22 tells us this. It says, finally the poor man died and was carried by the angels to sit beside Abraham at the heavenly banquet. Very interesting statement here. The poor man dies probably from his maybe the disease, maybe his malnutrition. He dies at some point. Probably not a long time later, who knows? He dies. But as Jesus is very clear in the story, life goes on. And he's carried beside the angels to sit beside Abraham. Now, remember who Jesus is telling the story to. Jesus is telling the story today to a bunch of Pharisees and religious leaders because they are making fun of his message to stop being greedy and be generous. All these Pharisees and religious leaders, they know Abraham. Abraham is their patriarch. Abraham is their father. They washed the sepulchers of the prophets of old while persecuting the prophets of the day. And they loved Abraham. And Jesus mentions this poor man ending up in this heavenly banquet where Abraham's at. Every person there, every religious leader there who's hearing the story is thinking to himself, that's where I want to be. I want to be in the big old banquet room where somewhere in the room with me I can see Abraham one day. And Jesus says this poor man Lazarus dies, and that's where he's carried by the angels to sit, not just in the room, but beside Abraham at this heavenly banquet. It's a remarkable visual for them. Now, the rich man doesn't die quite yet. We're going to see here he's going to die. He lives longer. How much longer? Probably a lot longer. He has health, he has money, he has means. And by the world's measurement, the rich man is a winner and Lazarus lost in life, didn't he? But Jesus mentioned earlier what this world honors. By the world's measurements, the rich man was a success. He had money. God must be favoring me, right? That's what people think. God must be favoring me. I got lots of money. He's blessing me. By the world's measurements, he lived a long life. Longer than this guy, God, I'm good. And by any other measure, people can look at Lazarus and say, what did he do wrong to be in that situation? I outlived him. Must have been something wrong, because it's easy for us to get that way about ourselves or others, and it's dangerous because how long we live and how good we live in this life has nothing to do with who is right with God. But we oftentimes make it into something like that. And in this world's measurement, the rich man was a winner. And Lazarus' life was a tragedy. But that all flips when the story page turns. Lazarus is carried by the angels into the heavenly banquet, sitting next to Abraham. It says in verse 22, the rich man also died, maybe sometime later, and he was buried, and he went to the place of the dead. The word here is the Greek word Hades. In fact, some of our older Bible translations might even use the word hell, some don't. But the place of the dead, Hades. And I want to point this out to you because if you don't understand this, you're going to miss the power of the story. It's so powerful. When the word, what we use as one English word, hell, across the board without thinking about it, is used in the scriptures, there's three different words in the Greek that are used. The one that is most used by Jesus is the word Gehenna. Jesus used it often. In fact, of the 12 times the word Gehenna is used in the Christian writings, Jesus used 11 of the 12. It always referred to, Gehenna was Gehinnom. It referred to the Valley of the Sons of Hinnom, which is an area just south of Jerusalem that used to be, before the Israelites lived there, a place where the people who lived in that land offered their children as child sacrifices as part of their religion. Gross, gross stuff. And they considered it a terrible area because of its history, and so they turned it into a garbage dump. They bring their trash, they burn their trash. You ever been to a place where they take trash today and they maybe pile up and they burn it today? This is a trash dump south of Jerusalem, Gehenna or Gehinnom. And it was a place where the fire never went out. The fire was always, always burning. They didn't just burn trash on that fire pit. They would also burn the bodies of criminals who were crucified or executed for their crimes, or if people were too poor to have a proper burial, they tossed their bodies into the fire pit at Gehenna. Honestly, in the story today, if this is more than a parable, if this is a person, Lazarus would most likely be tossed into the fire pit at Gehenna because he's a poor man, no one would claim, and his body would be consumed there. That fire was always burning. And Jesus often referred to Gehenna as a topic of judgment, of ultimate judgment. What you do is going to matter, and you're going to face the music one day. And he referred to Gehenna as the term that we translate hell. Very seldom did Jesus use the word Hades. Just a couple times in different contexts. He uses the Gehenna 11 of its 12 times, and the other time is used by his half-brother James in the book of James. But a couple times Jesus uses the word Hades, and that's an interesting word. And he uses it here to tell a story, to tell a lesson to his audience. Hades was the closest Greek word for the old Hebrew word Sheol, which is the word that we translate from the Hebrew, that we translate in our Hebrew scriptures to be hell. But Sheol in the Hebrew scriptures was always referring to a place of the dead. The word is unseen, by the way, the unseen. The place of the dead, where they believed that both good and bad went there, but they were in different kinds of existences. In fact, they believed that, you see Job and David and others talking about going there one day. And so in the Greek, we have to go before Jesus came around, 700 or 800 years before Jesus shows up, the Greek Empire came, Alexander the Great, they left. Now the Roman Empire rules, but Greek influence and literature is everywhere. And so about 200 plus years before Jesus shows up, the people of Israel were translating their Hebrew scriptures into Greek. They called it the Septuagint. You might know that. It's actually interesting because 200 years before Jesus, there was actually some Bible translation debates back then, which is kind of funny. But largely, they decided to translate into Greek because that's the kind of the coming language. And so they translated it into the Septuagint. And when they translated that word Sheol, that we use as hell in the English today from the Old Testament, they translated that word in the Greek to Hades, because it's the closest representation of the same word, but it was weighty, because for the last 7 centuries or more, Hades was a thing in Greek culture. I want to give you a little background into the Greek understanding of Hades so you can appreciate what the word meant to them. In Greek culture, Hades was both a person, and it was a Greek demigod, and he was also a place of the dead, much like Sheol in the Hebrew. A place where both the good and the bad would go. There's different kinds of spots. In fact, in their culture, it's kind of weird that when the person died, they would have to be escorted across by Hermes across the river Styx to the place of judgment. It would be guarded by a three-headed dog named Cerberus, I believe is the name. And they guard the entrance. And you could get in, but you could never get out, they believed. And once you face judgment, you would go to one of three places. And one was kind of a middly, weird, meadowy place where spirits floated around and became gray and forgot their stories and who they were. And then there was a place where the heroes and the demigods and the powerful and the really exceptionally good, and maybe the ones who had enough money, would go. You actually had to pay a toll to cross the River Styx. We're having a whole conversation somewhere, carrying on. You had to pay a toll to cross the river in Greek understanding of Hades. And that's why, this is crazy. Some of you don't know this, but you'll find this to be interesting. People believing that to be true in ancient times, what they would do is they would bury them, have people bury them with a gold coin in their mouth. Because they believe they got buried with a gold coin in their mouth, that they have the coin to pay the toll to be taken across to Hades to get to the good place. And of course, then there was the bad place, Tartarus, which actually is another word used in the New Testament, one time that we translate hell. Tartarus is used one time in 2 Peter to refer to the lowest hell, a place that's named by the scriptures as for the devil and his angels. But anyhow, it's all part of this understanding of Hades, this Greek place for centuries before Jesus comes around. And here he always talked about hell as Gehenna, fiery judgment for our decisions. But in this one story and a couple other spots like it, he decides to tap into the Hades idea. But he turns some things on their head a little bit. For example, people would think, well, if you had that coin in your mouth, because you are rich enough to do that, it will help you get into across the river. And Jesus tells a story where the poor man Lazarus had nothing, but the angels carried him right across the place to Abraham. By the way, in Hades, in the Greek culture, the belief about the good place was they called it paradise. They referred to it as paradise. And their belief was that, you know, in fact, Jesus actually uses that term on the cross. He says to the thief next to him, "Today you'll join me in paradise." A lot of people believe that that when Jesus, you know, died according to Ephesians 4, 1 Peter 3, and 1 Peter 4, that he preached the gospel to those in prison in that place. And he leads captivity captive. There's a whole thing going on there that we can discuss. I'm nerding into space that needs a whole Sunday, so I got to stop myself because I get excited, so it doesn't matter. But point is that Jesus, you know, Lazarus dies and he's carried into this place, but he has no money. There's no gold coins in his mouth when he was tossed in the fire pit. And the rich man had all the money, but he wakes up in the bad place. And so he's turning the ideas of the culture on their head to teach a principle. It says, verse 23, there in torment, the rich man, he saw Abraham in the far distance with Lazarus at his side. Now, in the far distance, he can see Lazarus there. And he's like, now, this is kind of weird too. Like, there's some kind of a view that nothing in that culture or in our Christian understanding today would understand why you could see from. It's a literary device to make a point. Jesus is telling a story to teach a lesson. And in his story, he decides to use a literary device that they can see each other to make his point to his audience about their greed and their lack of generosity. So in the story, he says that Abraham is in the distance and the rich man is in torment. He can actually see him. And Lazarus is next to him. And in verse 24, the rich man shouts, "Father Abraham, have some pity. Now who's begging? Now who's desperate? Now who needs help?" The rich man does. Here's what he says. He says, "Send Lazarus over here to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue. I am in anguish in these flames." It's interesting, if you read that carefully, that the rich man still does not acknowledge Lazarus directly. Did you notice that? He still doesn't even say anything to Lazarus. He says, he looks at him and says, "Hey, Abraham, send Lazarus to serve me." His whole life he's ignored Lazarus. He walked past his house every day and ignored the poor man and said nothing to him. And now that he sees him in the good place, he still doesn't talk to him. He talks to Abraham because he's the great patriarch. "Hey, Abraham, can you help me? Can you send Lazarus to be a servant like he should be, to come out and serve me, help me in my torment?" That's what he could do. Have him dip his finger in some cold water and touch my tongue as I'm in torment. And look what Abraham says in verse 25. "But Abraham said to him, 'Son, remember that during your lifetime, you had everything you wanted and Lazarus had nothing. And so now he is being comforted, and you are in anguish. And Jesus is making a very intentionally contrast. This is how it was, you didn't care, and so now here's how it is, and that's how it is. You want Lazarus to dip at the tip of his finger in water to cool your tongue, but when he was alive and you were alive, you wouldn't lift your finger to help him once. But now you want him to lift his finger to help you. And then he says this in verse 26. He says, and besides, there's a great chasm separating us. No one can cross over to you from here, and no one can cross over to us from there. Again, is this more of that view that they have, or is this a literary point to make the application? Is this how it was? I don't know. We can debate that and try to figure that out all day. But here's what we know Jesus is saying through the story. He's saying, it's too late. There's nothing that can be done to help now. Because let me say this to all of us. In our lives, not just when it comes to the afterlife, but even in our lives, there comes a point for all of us where it's just too late, isn't it? It could be in a relationship that you're in. And you could be neglecting or abandoning or mistreating a relationship over and over again until one day, and they put up with that. You think, oh, it'll always work out until one day it doesn't. And then, well, now it's too late. You can be bad at your job and do things unethical and get grace and think, well, no one cares and it'll be okay and as long as you want to until one day it catches up to you. And then when it's too late, it's too late. You can do that in your health and your finances. And at some point, there's a spot, and Jesus is saying in the story here, he's like, listen, you had a lifetime to figure that out. Now it's too late. So the rich man changes his request in verse 27. Then the rich man said, please, Father Abraham, at least send him to my father's home. Notice he's still not addressing Lazarus directly. He never does. He just tells Abraham, send him to do something for me. Send him to my father's home. Why? He says in the next verse, for I have five brothers, and I want him to warn them so that they don't end up in this place of torment. This is the most compassionate side we see in the story of the rich man. By the way, I have a lot of compassion for the rich man. Whatever, we're talking about hell as a bigger topic one day and what all that means and doesn't mean and all the things. Here's the thing I want to say. I always worry about people who revel in the idea of hell or feel puffed up and like it or argue and get mad at people for, you know, putting down my idea of my sanctity of loving the idea of hell. I'm always like, it ought to break our hearts, the idea that anyone would ever, on any level, short-term or long-term or anything else, suffer like that. I hurt for the rich man in the story, despite his own selfishness. It's tragic. And if you don't think so, then you need to get some psychological help. I've met a few people like that in my days. But here's the thing. He shows a moment of compassion. He's worried about his family. He's like, someone warned my family. I don't want them to end up. He decides, we've been mentioning Ebenezer Scrooge the last couple of weeks, so I'll use Ebenezer Scrooge. He wants an Ebenezer Scrooge story for his family. Remember that story by Charles Dickens called A Christmas Carol? Some of you have watched the movie, but not read the book maybe. But anyhow, in the story, Scrooge is on a bad path to destruction. And so what happens? Dickens says that his old partner, Marley, returns from the dead to warn him to change his ways before he is too late. Remember, he shows up and he haunts him and he's like, what's that long chain and all those heavy things you're dragging behind you? He's, I forged this chain link by link throughout my lifetime. He says, and by the way, yours was, look at it carefully. You should recognize it. Yours was every bit as long as mine 7 years, Christmases ago. And you've been working on it ever since. And he's there to scare Scrooge and warn him, change your ways or your fate will be my fate. And the story that Jesus is telling the Pharisees here, he's telling the same thing. He's saying, the rich man is like, send this guy back from the dead to haunt my brothers. Have them go back and tell my brothers, don't end up here. That will scare them straight. But look what Abraham says in verse 29. But Abraham said, Moses and the prophets have warned them. Your brother can read what they wrote. I don't think we know how punchy that statement is. And I don't think we know because we don't leave the story for a moment. Remember who Jesus is talking to. He's talking to a bunch of religious people, Pharisees, who showed up making fun of his teaching to be generous and not greedy. And he says, basically what he's saying is, you're the brothers that are supposed to get the warning. You're the brothers. And the man says, send them to warn my brothers. And he says, no, they have Moses and the prophets. Moses and the prophets will be their scriptures, the law and the prophets, what we call the Old Testament. They're Hebrew scriptures. He says, you already have that. You have all that you need to warn you. That's what he's saying. He's saying, you have all the tools at your disposal to know what to do. All the scriptures that tell you to love God and love your neighbor as yourself, and make it very clear over and over again, it's all right there. You don't need anything more than that. Pretty powerful statement to his audience that Jesus is teaching the story to. He goes on. The rich man, verse 30, the rich man replied, no, Father Abraham, but if someone is sent to them from the dead, then they will repent of their sins and turn to God. If someone comes back from the dead, ooh, then they'll change their tune. Then they'll repent of their sins. That will work. Verse 31, but Abraham said, if they won't listen to Moses and the prophets, they won't be persuaded, even if someone rises from the dead. Whew. That's a powerful statement. There's a lot of layers to that statement. The obvious one is Jesus. I'll come back to that in a moment here. Let me just say this to you real quick. We know that's true. You know that's true. I know that's true. That people who are set in their mindset, set in their beliefs, set in their ways, set in their behaviors and justifying them, won't change their minds even in the face of a miracle. We know that, don't we? Can I give you an example of how true that is? Look no further than Moses and the prophets. Look at the Hebrew scriptures. Let's rewind. 1,500 years before Jesus. 1,500 years earlier, remember what happened to the children of Israel? They were in slavery in Egypt. And Moses comes along and brings them out. And what does God do? God sends plagues to the Egyptians. Someone tell me, how many plagues did he send to the Egyptians? 10. To get their attention. Miracles. And they finally leave Egypt and they get free and they're going out and they come to the Red Sea and they're being chased and he parts the Red Sea. Miracle. They walk across on dry ground. The enemies are drawn behind them. Miracle. They're led by a pillar of cloud by day, a pillar of fire by night. They're fed with manna from heaven 6 days a week and a rock that travels with them that gushes water. Miracles. In the story, they end up at Mount Sinai where Moses goes up to meet God to give laws because they were a newly freed slave people that never had to govern themselves. So they're going to get laws to govern their newly founded nation. And Moses is going to get them from God to govern and set their policy. And when he gets to the mountain, there's lightning and thunder and fire and a voice of God, and it's miracles. And yet, even in the face of all that God had done, what happens next? They stay for 6 long weeks waiting for Moses to come down, and they finally say, eh, take their golden jewelry, make 2 golden calves, and say, these are the gods that brought us out of slavery. These are the gods we worship from now on. It's not a new story. It's a tale as old as time that we, miracles and proof and obviousness won't change our minds when our minds are made up. And that's what Jesus is saying right here. You want something special? It won't change anyone's mind. Remember the Revelations, the end times, apocalyptic writing of Revelations? There's a spot in it where the heavens are scrolled back and people who are fighting God finally see him literally in above them in the story. And what do? Do they believe? No, they shake their fist and curse him. Because what won't change our minds? We know it's true. None of the proof ever works. Can I pick on, let me mention politics. We don't get into politics here. We're all across the aisle in our church politically. But let's be honest. People who are really political, politically charged, one side or the other. My side's right, their side's evil and bad. My people, my leaders I like are great and yours are all bad. What happens when proof comes to the person that they don't like did something good? They say, oh, that can't be. There's another explanation for that. When proof comes to the person that they love is bad in some way, oh, no, it's fake. That's fake. That couldn't be. Because proof means nothing to us because we live in a post-truth culture. It's been that way for 3,500 years. That people are going to believe what we want to believe no matter how obvious it is. And Jesus is telling a story where he says, you're the brothers, guys. The rich, the Pharisees among them are the rich people who are scoffing at his teaching of generosity. He's like, hold on now. If someone came back from the dead to warn you what the scriptures already told you, you still wouldn't believe them. And then you know what the cherry on top is going to be? Jesus is going to do it himself. He dies and he rises from the dead. And they did not believe him. He called it. Jesus spent his whole life calling his own death and resurrection. I'm going to die, I'm going to rise again. I'm going to die, I'm going to rise again. I'm going to die and rise again. No one believed it. His own disciples couldn't understand it. And then he went and pulled it off. And then people are like, oh, I believe. But these religious leaders he's talking to, did they believe? No, they persecuted his disciples afterwards. They killed his disciples afterwards. They kept the pressure on because he was right. If you won't listen to the scriptures that you have right now, if your mind is made up, if this is how you see these, if this is what you're defending and living for and believing, you won't be changed. No matter if someone rises from the dead right in front of you, you still won't believe it, and I'll prove it to you in a few years or a few months. It's pretty powerful. It's a pretty powerful statement he makes. And then the story ends. The story ends. I mean, like, Jesus is like, okay, time for coffee, lunch break, have a good afternoon, and he just leaves, or whatever. They're like, what about the thing we're talking about? You know, that's all you need to know. I think he didn't finish the story. I did. He's supposed to be like, where's the gospel part, you know? He's like, well, that's why I'm here, to die and rise again, so if you believe on me and pray this prayer. He doesn't do any of that. He just like, here's a story for you about a greedy booger like you, and out comes, since you like my story so much, here's one for you all. Okay, have a nice day, toodles, and he leaves. And I'll be honest with you, every single time I've ever heard this story throughout my life taught, it was always taught to teach about theology, about the afterlife. And that's fine, because there's things in there that are fascinating to talk about. We did a little bit of that today. But here's the crazy part. Jesus never told this story to teach doctrine about the afterlife. He took a reference point to teach a lesson about greed and generosity. And I've never heard someone tell this story to teach about greed and generosity, but that's what Jesus did. And so if I can just be bold enough to do what he was trying to do and give us an application in context, let me just give you a statement to take home with you today, and that is a couple statements. First of all, it's this. In the end, we will always be tormented by our selfishness. That's the bottom line. In the story today, they were mad at him for saying, you know, be generous, don't be greedy, and they got mad and they scoffed, and so he tells them a story about a person who did not listen like they weren't listening, who ended up tormented by his selfishness. And Jesus is saying, listen, you need to understand something very plainly. That's how it always goes. That when you hold back from other people, not only do they suffer because you hold back from them, but in the end, you suffer too. And not just the afterlife. It happens in this life all the time. Many of us have lived long enough to know that we have chosen to be selfish or greedy about our own lives, and not only not benefited others, but at some point, it bit us also. Because that's always the outcome that Jesus is teaching. You say, well, Arlen, it's such a negative story, such a downer. I know, but here's the thing. I didn't write it, okay? It's not my story. I'm just passing it on. So I know it's a real downer, but Jesus, remember, let me give you this reminder. Jesus told this story right after the first story he told to his disciples about the man who he said, be generous. And so if you want a positive takeaway, a positive action step, look no further than what Jesus said last week, which is what? He said, use your resources to benefit others, and you'll find a benefit too. It's the same principle on the positive. Just like if I hold back from other people with selfishness, it hurts them, but in the end, it hurts me too. On the flip side, when I use what God gives me to benefit others, it also ends up benefiting me. And that's what he was teaching in these two stories together. In fact, what it comes to is a statement I want to give you that is so scriptural, it ought to be in our DNA. And it looks like this. What you do returns to you. This principle in scripture is so frequent and so common, we overlook it. What you do returns to you. Can I just make my case for a moment here before we go? Jesus said elsewhere, what does he say? Give and it shall be given unto you. What you do returns to you. Jesus said elsewhere, blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. What you do returns to you. He says, if you don't forgive others, your Father in heaven won't forgive you. What you do returns to you. If you forgive others, you will find forgiveness. What you do returns to you. Last week's story, he says, use your goods to benefit others and you'll receive benefit too. What you do returns to you. This week's story, the rich man and Lazarus, what you do returns to you. This is a principle for life that Jesus is driving home, and he's telling a story to help make the point to people who weren't interested in listening, but I hope we are. And he never gives an invitation. He never gives an altar. He just says, chew on that. Have a nice day. And so I'm going to do the same thing today. I'm not going to relieve any tension that Jesus does not relieve here. I'm not going to put a bow on it that he doesn't put on it. I'm going to leave us in the tension of the story for the day, because the gospel is throughout the whole message of Jesus, and it's coming on strong when we get to the cross. But right now, let's leave it where Jesus left it. A reminder to us, whether we fall on the side that leans towards generosity or leans towards greed, that we're called to care for others, to give to others, to serve others as God did for us, and what we do returns. And that's our point today.